Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Other F Word Podcast. We are very excited to have on, I think he called himself my new best friend,
Mr.
John A. Cuff. He's a writer, speaker, and actually, I will say, John, the funniest guy I know on social media. I think you do social media really well, which is a tough thing. So I'm really excited to talk to you about failure. Thanks so much for coming, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
John, on the social media thing, I have a friend who he's the nicest, sweetest guy ever. He's trying to like calm down a situation. And people were so mean, and it really, I know it's been hurtful to him. And I was wondering, like, how do you deal with that? Because you really do social, you keep it fun. It's a tough thing right now in this world. And I think, you know, we talk about a lot with our kids dealing with it. So how do you deal with that kind of thing?
Social media to me is a wasteland right now. Like, believe me, I use it a lot. I like it. But gosh, it is. I want to tweet, like, say a prayer for the people arguing underneath a politician's tweet. Like, it's the worst. Go look at something like either side. I'm not like, I like, it's dumb to be like, Democrats say bad things, Republicans say bad things. No, humans say bad things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of changing my approach on it in that. Like, I'm trying to say to people, one of my big principles is treat it like real life, not like fake life. And they go, what do you mean? I go, okay, so if Dragonheart Mark 287, like, in real life, drove by your house, rolled down his window in his car and was like, your yard sucks, I bet your heart does too, you would be like, what a psychopath. But like, and you would have been like, the craziest person drove by my house and yelled at me. You wouldn't think about it again.
Yeah.
But when a digital person says it to you, you go, I should really take that in consideration. I should think about that. Like, I should, like, the other day somebody said, I lost a lot of respect for you. And I wanted to say, like, you shouldn't have had much to begin with. Like, what do you, like, we've never met. Like, I don't, like, your bar was too high. I'm a jerk. Like,
well, so we're human.
I just try to, like, and when you take that filter of in real life versus fake life. So, for instance,
right.
Twitter has a feed, like a feature called mentions that shows me every time somebody mentioned me that day. Like, that, how in the world is that possibly helpful? Like if I came home at the end of a real day and my wife said, hey, I wrote down everything I heard people say about you today in our town, you probably want to read it. I'd be like, I sure don't. Let me see what people say about, like, So I just think you have to look at it and go, it's a tool, there's value there. I've seen, like, we built two kindergartens in Vietnam, largely using social media. So I'm not an anti-guy.
Yeah.
In the same way as a parent, I'm not like, the internet's a porn machine, like constant porn. Like, no, the internet does some amazing things. But I'm also not a, like, the crowd's always right, it's good for you. I got to a point where I realized I couldn't remember the last time I felt better about myself and my life after using Twitter.
Right.
I was like, huh, like, that's not good. So I'm trying to do more creating and less kind of engaging in, like, just the vitriol. And then my big thing is this, like, I put this in my book. I just wrote this book called Finish, like, that the reason people are so angry online is that it's their only form of passion. Like, if you don't express the passion you're supposed to express, it doesn't go away. It just turns into poison.
Mm.
And it's like, imagine a river where there's seven different channels and tributaries. If all six of them are blocked and there's only one called anger, you go online and you unleash again and again and again and again. Like, and then, like, you put it through your crazy town filter where, you know, like people are nuts. And then you get race and gender and all these real issues. Like, people sometimes say to me, why don't you talk about such and such issue? And I'll go, because it deserves more than a tweet. Like, it deserves a long coffee with a friend.
Wow.
Like, I'm not gonna denigrate that issue that somebody struggles with to 140 characters.
A soundbite.
Like, it matters more. And I'll never be able to write it in a way that won't hurt somebody. So it's dumb. Like, you want to have coffee and talk about it? Let's do it. But I'm not doing it on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's so smart because it's you're kind of taking care of the issue. You're not just being casual. You're thinking about it. And I think social media requires that, and yet we all I think get so swept up by it. And I think it's like a false sense of connection. People think they're connecting, and we do connect, but it's more on a surface level. So to hear that you have kind of a strategy for how you do it in a healthy way.
Well, and also there's not a lot of humility out there. I remember one time at our church, they'll give a little homework, or they used to, they don't do it anymore. But this one guy, it always stuck with me. He was like, anytime like somebody cuts you off in traffic, be like, that person's, I'll say, a jerk. And then you add, just like me, you know, like that person did that. Like that, I can't believe that person did that, just like I've done before. Mm-hmm. You know, there's none of that online, you know?
100%. And like, here's the other thing that's really fascinating that nobody likes to admit. Like, nobody likes to talk about this because we like to think the opposite. So there's been all these studies since like the 1930s about how Kurt Lewin, this social psychologist, did it. And Derek Sievers talked about it. Like, Derek Sievers, this author, exposed me to it. I mean, I just saw a video where we don't know each other. And there's this concept that if I tell you my goal the wrong way, I'm less likely to do it. So if I say to you, hey, I'm going to run a marathon, most people will pre-congratulate you. They'll go, good for you. You're so brave. Like, you're so disciplined. I could never do that. And then your body releases dopamine, and it's enough dopamine that you're satisfied and you don't actually run a marathon. So like, the reason 81% of Americans, according to New York Times, want to write a book and less than 1% do every year is because they go to dinner parties and they say, hey, I'm writing a book. And everybody goes, that's so brave. Like, I could never do that. And you go, I am brave. Thanks for thinking that. That's a good point. I'm pretty brave. And dude, I promise you, social media is the amplification of that.
Yeah.
Because I go online and I go, I'm against blank. And then people go, thank you for using your voice. That was amazing. You don't think a single thing in your own community. So like, I love that you tweeted against, like, and I love when people tweet stuff like, I think the world needs more love and less hate. Retweet if you agree. Who's going to be like, nah, more hate. Hashtag team hate. I'm a big, like, and people don't like to admit that because when they hear that, they think you're attacking social activism or whatever. Like, don't get me wrong. I think there's a time and a place for that. But I just wish Twitter was like, had a, like a machine where before you got to be angry about an issue online, you had to work for an hour in your own community.
Yeah.
And then you could be like, all right, I just did this thing. Like, and here's what I'm mad about. And like, I've used my voice and my hands. But that's not the culture we live in. We live in like crazy town.
It's so true. And there's no subtlety, I guess. It's all black and white, and there are no nuances in social media, I guess. So it's like you, I mean, everybody's wanting these simple, you know, easy, quick solutions to things. And I think that's also what appeals to people about social media. Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the things I loved about your book, John, so much, is you really take finish. And just like you're saying, when you want to run a marathon and somebody tells you, like, you really flip a lot of stuff on its head. And I can say this as a constant starter that you talk about your book, because I literally, we have this thing in our house, it's so bad, starting Monday, because we like break by Wednesday. It's like, all right, starting Monday, no sugar, you know, and it's like Tuesday. But you really take a lot of stuff and flip around the way we think about it and how we've been thinking stuff, you know, in wrong terms. So I just love that about your book.
Well, and for me, I mean, that's kind of one of my passions is I like to take stuff we've all been told to believe and then go like, but is it true? Mm. And so, you know, and the problem is we have so many pseudo Instagram gurus that like, that have big followings, like,
yeah,
that'll have a million people. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. This is like the whole like, oh, if you say it out loud, the universe conspires to help you. Like, no, it doesn't. Usually the universe is like, ha ha, like, now I got you. Like, there's so much of that I want to be positive about it. So I'm not saying like, it's not helpful if you go, this is wrong and that's all I'm going to say. It's helpful if you say, this is wrong and I think there's an even better way that'll give you like even better results. Like,
yeah.
I sometimes people say, oh, your stuff's too safe. Like, and I think it's not too safe. It's just trying to be smart. Like, you don't have to do it the dumb way. Like, and there's no shame in going, hey, is this going to work? And if it's not, like, so for instance, I have this new thing. I haven't even launched it yet. Maybe by the time this podcast goes up, it'll be launched. I have so many people that are like, I want to write a book. I want to write a book. I want to write a book. And that's awesome. Write a book. That's fantastic. But I know most of them won't. And I believe it's really painful to carry around the unmet expectations of a fake dream. Like, there's a degree of shame about that. Like, mm-hmm. I should have written it by now. I don't know what to do. I'm not, you know. And so I have a website called Okay, You Want to Write a Book. Mm-hmm. And it's a $10 PDF that tells you how to write a book. And my hope is that you'll either have what you need to write a book or be released from the tyranny of thinking you need to write a book. Mm-hmm. Like, and maybe even you don't even want to buy it. And you're like, $10, forget it. Congratulations. I freed you for free. Tell you, like, go do something. Like, and it's weird because writing is the only art form we and in LA, I guess, movie making. But writing in general is the only art form people think they have to do. I never meet people that go, I know I've got a sculpture in me. I had a teacher tell me I should deal in granite. Like, we never feel that. And so, like, I don't know. People, again, like, I don't like cynicism, but I don't like false optimism either. So I don't like when people go, everyone should write a book. No, they shouldn't. I shouldn't record an album.
Right.
And that's okay. Like, I don't feel failure about that. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
No, and we've had somebody on and Sarah's big on this, kind of the extreme self-help can really create a lot of unhappiness because you're trying to get these things and, you know.
Well, the pressure. And then you do walk around feeling like a failure all day, every day. So I love your approach because it's so kind of realistic. It's confronting the reality of your dreams. And I like what you do. You kind of shrink them down to maybe more appropriate size, right? Maybe you could talk a little bit about the goal setting ideas you have.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, a big part of it is we culturally believe things like aim for the moon because even if you'll fail, you'll land amongst the stars. And so it's kind of like we have these like crazy dreams. This is or like you'll see people on Instagram that'll say, if your dream doesn't scare you, it's not big enough. And like it sounds good on like a mug or like a CrossFit wall. Like, does that really work? And so I had a theory, and the theory was kind of simple. The theory was if you try to lose 10 pounds and you only lose 8, you don't feel like you almost did. You feel like you failed by 2 and you give up. Mm-hmm. Most people judge their goals on a past fail basis. Like, most people would rather, especially perfectionists, they'd rather get 0 than a C minus. So an example of that is the person, your friend group, the person with the messiest car, the messiest office is often a perfectionist. And you go, but I thought they were neat freaks. They are. But unless they can clean it to like the toothbrush level, they won't even start.
Right.
And mm-hmm. So I had a theory that if you cut your goal in half and tried to lose 5 pounds instead of 10, and say you lost 8. You lost the same exact 8 pounds, but this time you won by 2, or you won by 3, and you'll try again. So my big thing, and so we tested that, and we asked, you know, this book was the first book I wrote with a PhD, which was so helpful. PhD named Mike Peasley. He's a professor now at MTSU in Nashville. And we asked the people in our research study, there's about 900 people, to cut their goal in half. And the people who did were 63% more successful.
Amazing.
And, you know, the greatest proof was when they'd say, didn't hit my full goal, but I'm going to try again. Like, the problem is people don't set New Year's resolutions. They set January resolutions.
Right.
And, I mean, one of my favorite stories in Finnish is this guy. He was working out pretty consistently, going to the gym like 4 or 5 days a week. And he's running and he's biking. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to do a triathlon. He's like, I signed up for this 70-mile, and he quit it all. Like, the goal was too big. He didn't say, I'm going to, you know, it's when people say to me, I'm going to get into running, I'm going to do a marathon. I always go, like, what about like a 5K or 10K, even just a K? Like, why do we have to go to Kona every time we get a bike? You know?
Yeah, so he had stopped the workout he was doing before he had the goal. So he stopped all of it?
He quit everything. Like, that's the problem. Like, I saw somebody, like, there's a great advertising lesson when they say, if you throw somebody one idea, they catch it. If you throw them 7, they drop all 7. So the real problem is you stop the stuff you are already doing. And so you go, might as well. It's kind of this like might as well thinking, like where people go, ate a French fry, might as well eat 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Like, right.
And I mean, we're talking about failure. Like, failure is tricky that way because if you fail a little, you give yourself a pass to fail a lot. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm already not perfect. Might as well just go all the way in. Like, that's pretty common.
It's what you said. I really liked what you said about how we live in a kind of pass-fail culture, I guess. You didn't quite put it like that, but it's true. It's like pass-fail, you know, win-lose. And there's no nuance or subtlety. And I think that's actually a very American thing. And what we were referring
Sarah's to... Sarah's Canadian. She normally brings that up by now.
Yeah. You know, as Canadians, but I'm pretty humble, I have to say. I do feel like that all or nothing, like that approach to winning and losing is very, very American in a lot of ways, which is why I think there's this real sense of winners and losers, and that then applies to, you know, to failing and to trying stuff, and then, you know, either you achieve it or you don't, and there's no in between. And have you noticed that? Have you looked outside, you know, sort of American culture and done any research on how it compares to other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is I have friends in Australia, and they would say they're very, like, where they see a difference is what they call tall poppy syndrome. And tall poppy syndrome is kind of, if you get too tall, your friends kind of help knock you back down to size. And that can be healthy in the sense of like friends keeping you humble and grounded. It can be unhealthy in like some cultures, like the Netherlands. It's like you can't be a big entrepreneur because that's showy and flashy. And so you just kind of have to do your thing and be quiet about it. Like there's been a bunch of chefs that have kind of come out of Denmark, Copenhagen, all these areas in that region that have kind of had to fight that idea of like, no, I'm going to do crazy food because that's what makes me come alive artistically. I'm not going to just do the traditional thing in order to fit in. But I do think so there is that sense in America of we celebrate the maverick.
Right.
We celebrate the big win. I think too, we celebrate the failure when it's like, if it's storybook. Like failure is funny to me because I don't know. There's this weird thing that happens with our heroes or our leaders where they either stop talking about their failures. Like they only talk like people say to me in speeches, you're so honest. And I barely have said anything. It's just the bar is so stupid low, cause a lot of leaders are afraid to be honest. So what they do is they talk about a failure from 20 years ago that doesn't sting anymore. Or they talk about all their wins. And I'd rather say like, boy, this bombed. Like, boy, like whenever I tell somebody like, hey, a month ago I had 6 people come to a book signing. It was pretty humiliating. Like they go, that's amazing. That's not hard for me to share. Like that doesn't hurt me that much, but it is current. And so I think, but the problem is I don't like when we falsify our failures. I don't like when you live in Hollywood. I don't like when actresses make up stuff like, oh, I was really unpopular in high school. And there's a party that's like, I think you were probably 6'2" and really pretty and pretty rich in high school. And I mean, I'm sure it's hard, but like people try to like, what happens is when people get successful, they want to identify with you. And so they end up saying stuff that's like, I'm just like you. And you're like, it's okay to just be you and me, just be me. We don't have to like create these fake failures in order to connect as an audience. And so like failure is interesting to me that way. But I think American wise, we celebrate big brash people. And we don't, you know, we, especially with Instagram culture is so weird to me. And like, I always, you know, it's another thing I tell people all the time, especially moms. I say in the 1980s, my mom could only compare herself to the 5 other moms that lived on our cul-de-sac. Mm-hmm. Like my mom in Hudson, Massachusetts couldn't judge herself against the mom in Bellevue, Washington, or the mom in Studio City, California. But now you can compare yourself to everybody and we've accepted that's normal and it's not. And so that's where like, I don't know, even when somebody goes, this is my no makeup photo, you can tell they did it deliberately. Like it's not exactly no makeup. It's like,
it's no makeup with a filter.
Like,
right.
It's still pretty well lit.
Right.
You know, like the stuff like that with like, I'm just like you, like, even when we try to be real, we kind of stage the real.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's all that stuff is very fun, like fascinating. I'm not saying my hands are just as dirty. Like every parent has had their kid do something cute that they then made them restage for the photo. Like,
where do you think you learned that kind of honesty?
Probably my dad. My dad started a church in the 1980s in Massachusetts, which was kind of unheard of.
Wow.
And so he didn't really have a choice to kind of fake it. So I think from him, like, there are elements there. And then just seeing other people do the opposite and me being turned off by that, like, and going, like, I have a friend and she's unbelievable. She's 35 years old. She started this thing that's like worth $250 million now. She's amazing, mom. And I was like, how'd you get started? She's like, I made a list of all the things people do in this space that I don't like. And then I did the opposite. And I was like, I love that. Mm. Like, that is amazing. You know, I just think that's so fascinating. So for me, I went to a speech and the guy did his standard message with no regard for who was sitting in the crowd. And it didn't serve the audience. So I kind of said, okay, if I'm speaking to a certain type of audience, like, obviously as a speaker, you bring roughly the same speech, but I'm going to do my job to customize it and adjust it to where they're at. That bothers me. So I think it's a great exercise to say to yourself, not in a judgmental, catty way, but in a way that says, okay, this thing bothered me. Like, I always tell businesses, every bad customer service experience you have should make you better at your customer service.
Absolutely.
So, like, it hit me today. Like, no, it was yesterday. I bought a $40,000 VW GTI that I love from a dealership. Called them up yesterday. I needed an oil change. And they were like, we'll call you back. Give us your number. And I was like, for an oil change? Like, my name should trigger something that goes, this dude actually bought a car here. He's not a $40 Jiffy Lube dude. Like, so I was like, dang, I didn't like that. So then my version of that is, every time I speak in an event, you're my highest paid customer. You should go on a list. And every time I release a new book, I send you a free copy. Because you are really important to me. Hmm. So I just like the idea of, you take your failures, you take other failures, and then you kind of figure out, you know, what would I do differently? Didn't I like about this? How did this so make great. Me feel?
Right.
Like, I think that's valuable.
So, John, have you ever had a failure that's kind of set you back? Really, you know, been hard for you? I mean, it's, you're so,
like, a failure that set me back.
Yeah. You're so, it sounds like you've worked through and been so thoughtful about so many things. And I wondered if there was ever a point where, or even continues to be times where you find you just are like floored by something and overwhelmed and just don't know what to do or just really feel lousy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, somebody the other day, I thought this was really interesting. They tweeted, and this is why I still like Twitter. Like, as much as I'll go like, it's a garbage heap. Somebody tweeted, if Batman is named Batman because his greatest fear is bats, what would your superhero name be? And I was like, that's a really interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tweeted that mine was Captain hasn't lived up to his potential. And I think that, like, you have to examine that and go, what does that mean? Like, okay, six books? Like, I spoke in Athens, Greece the other day and paid me money to hear my ideas. Like, what's this fictional standard I'm trying to live up to, and where did that come from and why did it come? So I think in general, there's that general sense of like inadequacy. What am I trying to be? But then I also think, like, from a career perspective, I think a bunch of people would have seen me leaving working for Dave Ramsey as a failure. Like, mm-hmm. I certainly heard that on occasion.
And did you do that? Because I've heard you talk about that a little bit. Did you do that to start writing books? Were you already writing books when you were working with Dave, though, weren't you?
Yeah, I did it because I wanted to be able to kind of control my destiny. I wanted to build my own thing. I've realized over the years, like, I'm highly unemployable. Like, I need to be doing my own thing. Hmm. And that's not failure. And so, no, and part of it was I just wanted to try things outside of the space they wanted me to try them in. And I wanted to really kind of grow who I was trying to become in my own way. But, I mean, you talk about, like, you go from you're on the radio with 8 million listeners telling them about your book to you're not. So, like, that's a big, you know, it was definitely the easiest path to fame. But at the same time, I don't know that fame was the thing I was trying to do. So, yeah, I could see I would say a bunch of people, like, even if you don't consider it a failure, because I have not regretted that decision for one second. Like, it's been so great. Like, their company's blowing up. So I don't think they're like, oh, man, John, like, what? But even if you don't feel that, you still have people that come up to you that act like you've lost a family member. Like, so that was weird to have people in a small town be like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, are you guys thinking of moving? And Jenny would be like, why? Like this is, we're fine. Like, what are you talking about? And so like, I know for me, the insecurity is to push back and go, I doubled my salary. What are you talking about? You know, like to all of a sudden kind of bow up and try to prove to a stranger that I matter.
Right.
And so I think that's, I mean, like as a specific situation that, I was fired from a job once and that was a failure and I deserved to be. I was a terrible employee. I was a jerk at a job once and I remember I wrote like a year later, 2 years later, I wrote apology emails to the two people, like my boss and my boss's boss. And my boss was like, hey, you know what? That was a crazy environment and we are all kind of out of control. Like, I appreciate your words. And the boss's boss said, yeah, I don't know what your problem was. Like, you were terrible. Like, she jumped on like, and it's just like, like that hurt.
Yeah.
You know? Like, and I wasn't doing it for them to say the certain thing because that's not an apology.
Right.
But like that, you know, I think there's all these things that if we're not careful, we kind of carry them around. It reminds me of like in Fight Club, there's this sentence where he says it's like having, and I think he's actually has a, like a cut, but it's a metaphor analogy or whatever. But he says it's like having a cut in your mouth that you occasionally touch with your tongue to for that burst of pain or to remember it's there. And I think there's things that we gather up in life where whether somebody you got fired or somebody said something really hurtful or somebody broke up with you that you carry along. And especially if you feel inadequate, it feels like proof. I think that's the great danger is that the reason people have a problem with compliments is that it breaks their belief that they're not worthy of something.
Yeah.
So most people reject compliments because they don't believe it. And they accept criticism because it validates their own inadequacy.
Well, and I wonder what y'all think about this, because I've always thought this, and maybe I'm totally wrong. Most of you may have an idea as a therapist. I probably am. But because I think like darker emotions are important to look at when you're having them and kind of deal with them and face them. But I also do think they're seductive in ways. And I think that's part of what you're talking about as well, John. Like there's something of like kind of that victim, like they give you some sense of comfort in a weird way, in a very seductive way. Well, yeah, you need to deal with them.
Yeah.
But I think there is that touching that like validates things or something.
Well, you know? I think it's safe when you just stay in the dark and you stay in the negative. It is safe because there's always risk to try something different, right? To let in the good.
Right.
Because then there's fear that it won't stay or when things fall apart, it'll be even more devastating, right? There's
And like John's saying, it's also your identity. So your identity is that.
It's not familiar.
So to
it's
shift
a different,
that is kind of...
Yeah, it's not familiar.
But I love what you were saying, John. We talk about all the time the need for repair after failure. We call it rupture and repair. And, you know, it's courageous to go back to your failures and own your part and communicate with people maybe you've failed with or to kind of clean it up. And yet it can be so painful, but it can also be so liberating because then you don't walk around carrying it so much.
Yeah, I think the hard thing is, I think it's an American thing to think you can fix things.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think there's the, you own the things you can own. Like I always say, like you never get to, you only get to fix the things you'll admit. Like, if you won't admit it, you can't fix it.
Right.
And so, like, but I think there's also this idea of the older I've gotten, the more I've realized and admitted there are some situations that no matter what I do can be repaired. And it's not, like, I can't judge that as failure. Like, it's, like, the new thing. Like, the new thing is the new thing. And, like, I can do my best. I can write the email, I can, you know, say the apology, I can repair things financially, whatever, but it still might mean that relationship is never going to be what it was. And, or that situation is never going to be what it was. And I used to have this kind of foolhardy belief that like, with enough charisma, enough time, like,
right.
And I'm not saying like, it'll always be toxic. Like, I think there's this middle ground of like, it was amazing. It's toxic. It's in the middle and it just is. And so I don't mean that in a negative way. I've just, like I'm 42 now and there's just been some things where it's like, wow, I did the 10 things that every book says I should do. And the person still doesn't believe this or want a relationship. I mean, it's like trying to change anybody. Like
sure,
to say
yeah,
like,
sure.
How, I, you know, I hate when people post simple stuff online like bad kids are the result of bad parents. Like, I know too many amazing parents that, like, one kid's a valedictorian, the other kid is super into drugs and dropped out of high school. And like, they grew up in the same home and they're a year apart. Like, it's not, I think we want to control things so much that sometimes so we try to control what happens after the failure, and you can't.
That's
so, and I don't think that's bad. I think that's just life.
Well, you're talking, I guess, about acceptance, which we also talk about on our podcast, which is really hard sometimes. I think it's really hard to kind of sit in that discomfort and the feeling of like, yeah, this is failure and I'm just going to have to accept it and come to terms with it. And it sounds like that's something you are conscious of and work at doing.
Yeah. And it's not, yeah. And I'm not, it's not fun. Like, believe me, the first, like, I struggle against it. Probably, like, I always joke that one of my goals in marriage is to shorten the distance between when my wife tells me something and then, and when I believe it's true. So like first year of marriage, she'd say like, hey, I think you should do this, this, and this. I'd go, whatever. And I'd be grumpy for like a week. And like now when she's like, hey, I think you should be da 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 da, I might think about it for an hour, but I'm like, yeah, that's a good point. Like, and I'd much rather her tell me something than, I think it's toxic for spouses to not say something and then after go, yeah, I thought that might happen. And it's like, well, then why didn't you tell me? And it's, well, you haven't created a space where I can tell you the truth. And right. So I'm getting better at the acceptance stuff, but there's still like, there's a, my wife and I, we went through a situation where like something terrible happened, but I didn't believe it had happened. And so like, I was like, no, everything's good. Everything's good. And she was like, oh my gosh, like you're being naive and arrogant. Like the rules apply and this situation is a mess and like, it's not good. Or like there are times where I would say, I got nothing bad to say about a certain situation. She'd say, that's a lie. That's a lie to look good. Like you have plenty of bad things to say about that situation because bad things happened. You just like tell the good things or don't say anything. Like don't try to, you know, accept that bad things happened. So that we can heal from them. If you you rush right into like, hey, everything's amazing, like it's fine, I've got, you know, turn your frown upside down, like use your smile like an umbrella, like it just doesn't help.
Well, we often talk about that it takes one person to kind of join you in the real feelings, and that it's so important to sit in that and look at it and not push it away and make it all shiny and pretty. Sounds like your wife is really good at being honest and forthright. Is she that person for you?
She's amazing. And like, she won't go along with me on like my crazy worries. like if I'm like, like I got bit by a tick the other day and I'm like, I'm Googling Lyme disease. And if I have Lyme disease, I'll refer to this podcast where I first admitted it. But she's just like, she'll be like, I'm not going to entertain that worry. Or like, I'm not going to go on that particular ride. I mean, I heard somebody once said, like, you need a full cup spouse, like a spouse whose cup is full. And Jenny is a full cup spouse and she doesn't care what people think about her.
That helps.
Which I'm the opposite. I care what every human thinks about me. Right. So we kind of balance each other out.
Well, I think that balance is so important because if you're both down at the same time, it can feel so devastating, you know?
The problem is like, if you're say the wife starts getting some fame or internet celebrity or whatever, and the husband throws gasoline on that, it's terrible. Or like if you naturally are like, I think that guy's taking advantage of me, and your spouse is like, they are, how dare they? And it's just like you spiral. Like I think it's difficult in a marriage where they amp each other up in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Well, I think
the time it comes to mind is when she, like, one of her first jobs, and it was just a bad situation. And I would just try to bark out solutions. And she was like, I'm not even asking for a solution.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I didn't say, help me solve this. Right. I just said, like, here's what I did for 8 hours today. Like,
right.
And then if I try to yell out a solution, I've just shut her down from the conversation.
Right. I think we forget we have to communicate and say, I just need you to listen. I don't want you to fix it. Because then it just
I don't want to fix right now. I just want to be able to say it out loud.
Yeah, but first we have to know what we're needing. And sometimes I think when we're in the middle of that failure or that overwhelm, we don't know. But I think it is so helpful.
Men are super good at noticing that and not trying to fix.
Yeah, right.
Read the cues.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I get it.
It always takes a ton of communicating, you know, and just being really present.
Yeah, and we were. You know, and I'm curious too, John, when you were saying that you, you know, that you want people to like you in some sense, what do you think about, like, because, you know, sometimes I think these kids, you know, I talk about the kids love YouTube, they want to be YouTube stars, all this stuff, but putting yourself out there in any kind of way today, you know, even with this podcast we were talking about, sometimes you say something, you're like, why did I say that? But you just get, you're kind of setting yourself up to get criticism and stuff, you know, and it's hard to put yourself out there and it's very vulnerable. Like, has that been a difficult transition for you in ways, or have you just gotten built some thicker skin with it and stuff?
I try to ignore it. It always cracks me up when somebody will say, I can't believe what that person said about you. And I'll be like, I didn't see it. And they're like, do you want to know what it was? I'm like, nah, I'm pretty good. What's going about my day?
That's
like,
good.
It's not like, and so I mean, I had a friend say to me, he said, hey, you want to know what Kurt Vonnegut told me about criticism? And I was like, yes. I didn't know you were friends with Kurt Vonnegut, you jerk. and he said Kurt Vonnegut told him that if Mark Twain had had Amazon reviews, he would have jumped off a building.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting because, again, it goes back to the real life thing, like what we talked about. In real life, at the counter of Home Depot, there's not one-star reviews saying, hey, careful. Like, but on Amazon, next to the buy button is somebody trying to tell you not to buy the thing I created.
Right.
And so I always tell people, judge a review. The word's wrong. A review used to mean educated. They were the Wall Street Journal. This is what they did for a living.
Yeah.
It's a customer opinion, not a customer review.
Right.
And if you change the word to opinion, you're like, whatever. That's just one dude's opinion. That's fine. And so I either don't look at it. I think one of the healthiest things you can do is screenshot it and send it to like your five friends via text and be like, look at this jerk. I do that all the time.
Or how about just like when you're writing something or you're doing a speech, like creating material, do you kind of like censor yourself a lot, or you just put it out there like as a creative person?
No, what I try to do, I mean, I do try to censor stuff because I don't want the argument. Like I'm a big ROI guy. So if I don't see a big return on it, it's not worth the argument. So like I wouldn't bring up something just for the argument if I felt like it's going to derail the whole thing. So like, but I will say, like, the other day I tweeted, I don't like these videos I see of dads who are disappointed in gender reveal parties when it's a girl. Like, I don't think that's healthy. I think it starts the disrespect of women from like before they're even born. Like the dad being like, oh, I'm so mad. Like, I don't think that's healthy. I don't think having a video of that is healthy. And so a bunch of people got on me about that. And my assistant was like, you sure you want to post a blog post about this too? And I was like, yeah, that's worth it. Like, as a dad of daughters, I think that's not a kind thing we do to women.
Right.
Like, and then we're like, it's weird that like women have a hard time. It's like, no, it's not. When they were, you know, in utero, we were like, oh, they're the sucky of the two options. Like, that's terrible. And so there are some things I'll take a chance on and write about. I think more than that, I really don't care about the critics so much as I do in a speech anyway, or a book, figuring out what your objection's going to be and answering it before you even have it.
Hmm.
So like, if I say in a speech, you're more successful if you enjoy the things you do, I know your pushback is, well, not everything I have to do is fun. No, it's not. I agree. And here's the solution to that. So like, I don't care about that person that hates what I'm doing, because it's not for them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, I always tell people, if I sold surfboards and you were in Kansas and we're like, your company's dumb, I'd be like, yeah, guess what? You live in Kansas. Like, so this isn't for you. These surfboards aren't for you. I'd be fine. Like, or if I had an amazing steak restaurant and you're like, well, I hate you because I'm vegan, I'd be like, that's awesome. Like, there's amazing vegan options in this city. Go enjoy them. Mm-hmm. This place isn't for you. Like, I'm not, and that's okay. Like, not, I mean, but that's a, you know, we talked about American things. Another very American thing is this thing I'm creating is for everyone. Mm-hmm. No, it is not. Like, it's not for most people, in fact. I would say the majority of people it's not for. And when you try to do that, you water down so much. Like, I don't know, maybe you guys have been on, I don't know what you do outside of this podcast, but like, there's certain sitcoms that you're like, this sitcom is so boring and so safe. And the jokes, it's like one, it's like 24 minutes of dad joke. And it's because they said, we want the widest possible audience for our thing.
Yeah.
And then they created it and you can tell, and you're like, boy, this is not good. Where you look at other shows where you go, yeah, not everybody's going to like this particular niche conversation, but it's like, I'll do very specific hip hop jokes and serious speeches that I know four people are going to get. At Bose, we made a mistake with our headphone division when I worked there, and Beats came out of nowhere and crushed us. And so I'll say, we made the classic headphone electronics mistake. We forgot about Dre. And like, people were like, oh my God. Like, I did it for those seven people, and it didn't cost the rest of the people anything. It was a 2-second joke. So I'm trying to serve those people versus like, if you stop trying to, I always tell people, like, don't try to convince people who hate you to like you. Convince people who like what you do to love what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the difference. I don't, you know, if you've, like, I love this when people come up to me and they'll go, I don't like to read your kind of books. Tell me why I should buy your book. I always say, you probably shouldn't. And they go, what? And I'm like, no, maybe you're not. I don't know your life. Like, maybe you're not. This isn't for you. I don't know. I'll say, go online, read the first chapter free. And they always end up buying it. Because they're expecting you to be like, it's amazing, it's got a blue cover, it'll help you finish your dream. Like, and they expect you to be fake. And if you're honest, like, dude, you might not even be like anywhere remotely near the target audience for this. And that's like, I don't worry about selling some of my books to college kids, because they don't have the bruises yet to really appreciate my books. Like, if you've been in a corporate setting for 6 months and realize, like, oh no, like, this is not what I thought it'd be. Do-over is a lifesaver. But if I tell you as a sophomore, I got a book that's going to change your career. Like, you're too invincible. Like, you're not vulnerable yet. So like, I'll see you 6 months after graduation and do-over will be like the best. But right now, it's like, don't even worry about it, dude. Like, we're cool.
It's a good book.
Well, it's so realistic. You're just so realistic about expectations.
Yeah.
Which I think is so important.
Yeah, I don't treat that as a bad word. A lot of people in my space are like, never be realistic. Oh. Never. Mm. I mean, you guys, I'm talking about gurus online. LA is like the land of gurus. Like, everybody there is like a yoga master doing paddleboard yoga, which always cracks me up because it's like, you combine two complicated, difficult things. And like, just go ahead and have an organic garden on the back of the paddleboard.
Right.
We get it. So that stuff cracks me up.
Enough is never enough.
Yeah. I like the way, I mean, I take this the right way, 'cause I'm not saying you're being mean, but I like the way you push back. Even I can like the self-help stuff, but I like the way you push back on the gurus and the, you know, if it's so big, you just believe it'll all happen. I mean, I love that you did a book finish. I think you talked about, you know, how you did a book start, but starting, and I totally agree with you. Like, starting is, people are like, you just start, but it is easy. I'm great at starting.
Starting,
you know,
easier.
I get all excited. I'm like, let me get my plan ready.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're doing really valuable work with the finish, and I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it was something I needed. I always tell people, the three things you look for when you're going to create a new idea, whether it's start a business, a podcast, write a book, whatever, the first thing you look for is, do you have like an overwhelming interest in it? Like, is there a question you're willing to spend 2 years answering and then 3 years like talking about? Mm-hmm. The second thing you look for is there a real need? Do people need it? The third is it missing in the marketplace?
Mm.
So I needed, like, I was really curious. Why don't I finish? Why don't I finish? Why don't I finish in my own life? Second, people came up to me like, I loved your book Start, but I've never had a problem starting. How do I finish? So I saw a need. Third, if you go to Amazon and type in the word finish, the first thing that comes up is dishwasher detergent.
Oh,
and so I felt like, I knew I had, it's like a Venn diagram. And if you like, and you need all three, because if you have an overwhelming passion, there's a need in the marketplace, but it's already there's a need for people, but it's already in the marketplace. You have a cake pop. Like if somebody told me today I'm going to do cake pops, I'd be like, dude, 10 years ago, you should have done cake pops. if you have an amazing passion, it's missing in the market, but there's no need. You have a hobby. Like I love that you're into ferrets, but nobody needs that. Like, there's no. And then if it's missing in the marketplace and there's a need, but you have no passion, you've created a new type of day job. And you might make money on it, but you're going to hate it.
God, it makes so much sense.
You're very wise.
Yeah. Now, last thing before we wrap up, you talk a lot or write a lot about fear. And I'm wondering if you can speak to some of the things that you've said about fear and around fear of failure. And because we talk a lot about fear and the shame, you know, of failing or the fear of that shame. And I wanted to know if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your approach to how to deal with fear.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting to me about fear is, you know, it's the same with goals. Like, it's asking what's the real fear? Like, in the same way, it's like asking what's the goal behind the goal? Like, a woman told me, I said, why, you know, what's the goal of your website launch? And she said, my goal is that everybody knows I made a good decision. I said, that's not the goal of a website. Like, that's like saying the goal of my book is that my dad loves me. Like, that's the wrong goal. Like, how do we tweak that? And she had a real goal. Like, she did. Like, it was great. But, like, with fear, take public speaking, because I'm starting to coach a lot of public speakers because I'm a nerd at it and I love it. People will say, I'm afraid of public speaking. And I'll always go, no, you're not. You're afraid of looking foolish, and that's a different thing. And once we can deal with that, then we can actually figure out how to fix it. But if your fear, like, you publicly speak all day. Like, you publicly spoke to somebody at the gas station.
Yeah.
You talked to coworkers. Like, those were public speaking moments. Like I always tell, like people tell me I'm not a public speaker. I'll say, if you ever need to ask for a raise, you've given an amazingly valuable public speech. Mm-hmm. So you're not afraid of public speaking. You're afraid of looking foolish. So then once we know the real fear, then we can start to address it and not eliminate it. I'm not like people sometimes be like, when did you stop being afraid? And I think that's just not true. Like I think you always have fears. Mm-hmm. And Hemingway said, you're always afraid of things because you just keep doing bigger things as the last thing worked.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think as your opportunities expand, so do your fears. And so, but if I know your fear is looking foolish, I can say, okay, let's address that. For one thing, the audience wants you to win. They don't want to see you fail. Most people that are afraid of public speaking think the audience is waiting for you to fail. That's not what they're doing. They're waiting for you to succeed because it's awkward to watch somebody fail publicly.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable for us. I'm in the audience. I want you to crush it. Like, I want it to be amazing. Why would I root for you to fail? Like, I want you to do great. Okay, great. And then you go, okay, making a mistake in a speech actually makes you human and people like humans. Mm-hmm. Like Yo-Yo Ma said, until I made my first mistake in a performance, I don't feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And once he has, you're like, all right, it's not perfect. It's fine. Like, here we go. Like, we can actually settle into it and breathe into it.
Right.
And then I'll say the mistake might be the best joke of the whole night.
Right.
Because when you make a mistake, you either move on or you sit on it and blow it up so that everybody gets a kick out of it.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. Having a sense of humor.
I can't help you deal with that fear unless we got the fake fear out of the way.
Yeah. It's going deeper. It's like digging deeper and really looking at things.
That's what so much of this work we talk about here is just about looking at whatever it is and being curious about what's going on and not avoiding it.
Right.
Like with failure and all these things. And John, seems like you're such a good version of that. Like you've really looked at like how you tick, how you work. It just seems like that's the people who deal with failure, at least and in a healthy way. I mean, no one deals with it perfectly. Just kind of are interested and curious about things that's going on with them.
Right. Not pushing it away and laughing about it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it is so connected. And we can all laugh at our failures and mistakes.
And I think that's one thing that John, is why I resonate with your work and your book finishes, because I'm such a big, like, I have to make things fun. And I love that you put that in there, by the way, because it's such a big part of value for me. You know, it's a big value of mine. So.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I appreciate that, because we're more likely to have fun. So I hope you had some fun here today.
Definitely.
Did you see how? Look at that smooth transition.
You are.
Did you guys
smooth,
see that?
Morgan. That was great, Morgan. You're the best.
Very LA.
So, John, How do you want people to find you online, your website or podcast or whatever you want them to send you to?
Or Twitter fight with you?
Yeah, I mean, all my books are on Inca, are on Amazon, obviously, where people are buying books these days. And then acuff.me, which is just A-C-U-F-F. And then on Twitter, I'm John Acuff. Twitter and Instagram, I'm John Acuff. Just one word, no spaces. So yeah, any of those places, it's fun to connect.
Awesome. Go out there and do it, people.
Thank
Go connect
you, John.
With John. Thanks so much,
Thanks,
John.
Best.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it, buddy.
Guys.
All right, take
Thanks,
care.
Man.
Have a great day.
Bye. Bye.
You too.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.